Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren. Now my co-host today is Mr. John Copenhaver. How are you doing, John?
I am doing very well. Fabulous today.
Fabulous. Well, you should be. Hey, you won that award and you killed a fish. Yeah. You know,
I won an award and I ate a whole fish. Yes, that's true. And I ended up, the school year has ended and the summer has started, so I think I'm particularly excited for a little relaxation, I guess.
Winning an award like that, does that sort of is that going to make you feel the pressure of a next book of doing something, do you think?
That pressure is already there. So I don't think that's, getting a Lammy is really changing that,
But I was thinking more that like, okay, so yeah, there's always the pressure of you do a book and if it's well received, then you got to follow up. But I just mean, because when you win an award, that means eyes are on you all of a sudden.
Oh, like, okay. You have to perform equally as well again. Yeah, sure. I mean, that's definitely true.
I'm trying to get you all hyped and worried about it so that you do.
I know you're trying to make me. Should I be anxious? Should I be worried?
Yeah. I'd be really worried. You know, not too many people can do a follow up. You know,
it's kind of a permanent state of existence for me. So I guess I'm not more or less anxious than before. But pleased enough to eat a whole fish. So.
Well, you're in better shape than the fish now. Anyway. For our vegetarian listeners.
Yeah.
No big deal. Well, now speaking of that, we've got a really, really good writer here. It's got quite the history, more of a noir. I can never say that word, but it's my favorite. Yeah. So we got Mr. Gary Phillips. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Alan and John. Yes.
I love the area of detective and dark and just the whole concept of your writing. Where did it start for you? Like what drew you into this type of writing?
Yeah, I think, I know I've been a mystery fan for a long time, and I suppose the genesis of that dates back to my childhood, where I used to watch those old reruns of Twilight Zone and those Peter Gunn and those kind of detective shows, which a lot of people in the audience wouldn't have any knowledge of because they're too young and I'm too old. And I suppose it always kind of just milled around in my head. And then when I was about, I guess I was around 9 or 10, I got this, it was a Reader's Digest book club that my aunt belonged to. Well, she wasn't really my aunt, but she lived with my uncle. So I called her auntie, but they were never really married. Anyway, Aunt Virginia, and she gave me a set of books because I was kind of a nerdy kid. Well, my mom was a librarian, my dad was a mechanic, so I kind of grew up reading as well as playing sports. Anyway, she gave me a set of books, and one of those books, two of those books, one was the collected stories of Edgar Allan Poe, which includes two of the C. August, is it Dupin, however you pronounce his name. Two of those stories, Murders in the Rue Morgue and The Purloined Letter, and there's a third one, but it wasn't in that collection. Anyway, it had those two stories, and then she also gave me the collected Sherlock Holmes stories, which includes obviously a lot of the short stories, which were mostly short stories, but also included A Study in Scarlet, which is the first novel, right, where we first meet Holmes and Watson. And I read those, and I think they kind of, made an imprint on my brain. So it only seemed natural that finally, I mean, and also, by the way, I was reading a lot of comic books as well then. Anyway, it always seemed natural that this would be the area that would draw my interest both as a reader, then eventually as a writer.
Yeah. I just been watching the Peter Gunn series. Actually, I'm on season 3 right now.
Yeah.
So I'm into all that, but yeah, I know a lot of younger people. It's rerunning on MeTV, so maybe some young people.
That's right. That's where I see it as well. And they were great. There was like these tidy half hour stories. I mean, some of it was a bit, you know, obviously a bit contrived because, you know, always Gunn would always have some snitch is not the correct word, but some contact, somebody who we knew in this or that realm of existence. Although, because it was, you know, late 50s, early 60s, you know, a beatnik or two would show up now and then. And invariably, a lot of times, a lot of the shows were set at night. And yes, but you would always have this grabber opening, right? You'd always have that little teaser opening. And it would be some kind of sensational thing that would then, of course, draw you in, keep you there past the, when you go to commercial and past the commercial, you'd have to come back and see, you know, see what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that style. I don't know why. Maybe it's just age as well, but
yeah.
I don't know. But you seem to have more of a point in your writing. Like even when you get into One Shot Harry, that's your newest book. Yeah. And I mean, there's more of a meaning to it. Like with Peter Gunn and a lot of those, there was some, you know, some it shows some, like you said, a wild beginning. Someone gets shot or something weird happens and it's kind of like, oh, okay. And then it gets into a story, but it's never too deep in those typical noir shows like that.
Right.
But
right.
You have a lot more character, I guess you would say, in it.
Well, hopefully, I think all of us as writers try to, you know, we try to plumb those depths, both of character as well as in a, you know, how that then plays out in the story. And I think for me, because of my background, and you know, I've had blue collar jobs, I've been a printer, I delivered dog cages, I've also worked in the nonprofit sector, and I've also been community organizer and a union representative. So anyway, all that to say is that all those kinds of experiences I tap, as well as coming up as I did, my folks being sort of that part of those black migrants from the South and the Southwest who eventually came West for better opportunities. So I heard those stories, particularly with my dad and his buddies, you know, sitting around the kitchen table playing dominoes and having a few beers, and all that stuff has always been with me, right? I guess it's kind of just now it's sort of seeped into my, beyond my head, it's into my bones, I suppose. And just the idea that there's a richness and a vastness to even ordinary people that we might pass on the street, or, you know, you go into the store and you do a simple purchase of, you know, a pair of shoes with the store clerk, but that store clerk might have a story beyond just standing behind that counter, handling, you know, the exchange of money for goods. And so I think that kind of has always interested me, and it gets you into then those spaces, so that even if you, in the context of your book, you know, are moving to some extent, moving pieces around on the chessboard, sometimes you kind of pause with this or that person and maybe try to give them a little something, try to give them a hint of something beyond just the idea, just the notion that they're just there to exchange, you know, words with your character to move the plot along, which primarily may be their function. But also you also want to then hopefully then give them a little aroundness, a little something there that maybe sticks better with the reader.
In your books here, and even the new one, are you starting your book with a question? Do you have like a question, or do you have a character and then you build it around that item, or is it something different?
Yeah, that's a good question, Alan. I think I start with, that's not true. I start different kinds of ways. But in this case, in One Shot Harry, I started with the character. I got fascinated with this idea of this guy who's kind of a crime photographer in early 60s LA. And he's, you know, he's inspired by two real life people. There was a Harry Adams. My character's name, Harry Ingram. But there was a Harry Adams who was a freelance photographer here in Los Angeles during that period. He wasn't really a crime photographer, but he took a lot of shots of just sort of life in LA. He was a black photographer, and he sold a lot to the black newspapers of the day and some of the black slicks like Ebony and Jet. When Martin King would come to town, when Malcolm X would come to town, when that kind of personage would show up, he would be there to take their pictures. He would be at their rallies or at their speaking engagements. That was kind of fascinating to me. I didn't know about him growing up, but I kind of stumbled upon him a few years ago. And then there's, of course, the more famous Arthur Fellig, a.k.a. Ouija, who was a fixture in 30s and 40s New York, among the five boroughs. And he had this a mobile photo developing lab set up in his trunk. And he would just sort of, he would have a police scanner going. He would drive around and he would take all these sort of lurid shots of people getting arrested, people having just been rubbed out in a mob killing, or, you know, husband or wife domestic thing. And, you know, the husband's laying dead there with a knife in his chest. He was just sort of notorious. And he actually inspired speaking of late 50s TV shows, he inspired a TV show called Man with a Camera, which starred Charles Bronson. And then years later, there was a early 90s film called Public Eye with Joe Pesci, who was built similarly to Arthur Fellig. And Pesci was essentially playing, they didn't call him Ouija in the movie, but he was essentially playing that character. So anyway, all that to say is that those two guys, and there was another third guy, that was actually a guy called One Shot Harris in Philadelphia, who I learned of a little later. Anyway, but those two in particular then helped to, in my mind, create Harry Ingram. But I also knew that I wanted to have Harry Ingram be a Korean War vet. I wanted him to be this kind of guy who is moving around Los Angeles that is changing. Not that he's necessarily unaware of it. I mean, part of the plot is, of course, Martin Luther King has come back to L.A. to speak at a rally. And this is 4 months before the more famous March on Washington in D.C. And this part is true, too. I mean, that is to say, King coming to L.A. at that point in April of 63. So once I had those sort of notions in mind, the character, Harry's character, his backstory, and this incident, I thought I could get a compelling story, or I could craft a compelling story from it.
Yeah. What's your relationship with your character? And I mean that in a way of a lot of writers I speak to that are fiction writers will describe their characters as like their children, their family, their mm-hmm. friends. Like there's all that sort of description. What's your feeling with your characters?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. Yes, they're, you know, they're my creation. I don't think they, unlike, well, yes, I was going to say something about, you know, I've heard writers talk about, you know, how their characters will speak to them. And I think maybe some of that's true. Maybe a little of that's true. But in the end, you know, I'm crafting them the way I want to craft them. I put them on the page the way I see fit. But it is certainly the case that if I'm in his skin or if I'm in the skin of his friends, I try to as much as possible understand and inhabit that point of view. So I guess he's not my child. He's not my stand-in either, but I guess he's my construct, to the extent that I'm a puppet master putting him through the paces. I suppose there's some of that, but there's also some of that which in which he is, or it occurs to me as I get to certain scenes how I might break from what I think I'm going to do, because I now know enough about Harry to figure out, well, really, what would Harry do, or what would Harry say in this instance? So I think in that way, I try as much as I can, as I've said, to, I think, inhabit them, to live in his skin for a while, and be able to then translate that to the page. But there are certain times, there are certainly certain times in a book, Once on Harry, or the books that I've written, where I want to achieve a certain something in the narrative, or a certain something in this part of the story, and as much as I can, then I, you know, craft or construct the incidents, the events that will then lead us to that point. But sometimes it doesn't work, or sometimes it does seem too inorganic, or it does seem too shoehorned in, so that sometimes you have to just step back and maybe you can't do that thing you intended to do, or maybe the thing you intended to do, now you got to do something different. So I suppose in that way, yes, I mean, the characters live to me in the sense that I want to be as true as I can to them.
Gary, you know, I'm so fascinated by the use of a photographer as a main character, mainly because I did it in my first novel. So, like,
oh, really? Yeah. I didn't know that. Oh, very. Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was a World War II. He's a World War II photographer who takes a photo of a crime scene. And the first book is very, a lot of noir influences. And I wonder, do you think there's a strong connection, this idea of sort of, I don't know, the lone photographer trying to record or make sense of the world through a camera, and like the noir aesthetic? Do you think there's a connection there? I mean, it seems like we both had this on our mind, but that's kind of a question I'm asking myself as well as you.
No, I like that. That's a great observation. I think, John, that you like the idea of, well, exactly, the and how, and I guess even today, I mean, you know, thinking about photographers today, or today, where we all have the ability to lesser or greater degree to take a picture because we have these machines in our pocket, which, you know, I've lived long enough to actually have been, you know, like I said, when I was a printer, you know, which, you know, you dealt with photography there in some cases because you had to, you know, convert them to maybe make a as part of a flyer. And the idea that, you know, you had to develop a photo, you know what I mean? and the idea now that you don't even have to do that. So that the classic photographer, and my guy, you know, uses a speed graphic that he, you know, inherited from this other guy during the war. And now he's, you know, running around taking these pictures, and he's kind of the self-taught guy. But even now, even Harry's starting to understand, oh, okay, I'm taking these photos. I'm taking photos of people doing, or at the aftermath of people doing bad things to each other. I guess, what does that say about me? What does that say about what I'm trying to capture? And that even Harry has to admit to himself that he couldn't, that if he went around taking, you know, being a wedding photographer, or you know, covering cotillions or what have you, that would just be so boring. It wouldn't be something he'd want to do. He does like the action. He does like the juice. I mean, he's not an adrenaline junkie in that sense, but yes, that even Harry is starting to understand he's trying to capture, he would certainly not say noir aesthetic, right? But he is certainly trying to capture a kind of, you know, undercurrent to life in Los Angeles mm-hmm. in 63. So is that, or the undercurrent is what draws him or what keeps him, his heart pumping. But he also understands that because he, and particularly now I've been working on the second book, because he's in a way foreshadowing, at least, you know, in the States, the murder of George Floyd, mm-hmm. Other such incidents where he takes pictures of the cops wailing on black folks.
Right.
He, you know what I mean? So that he understands he does not, skirt those situations. He inserts himself in those incidents. And sometimes, of course, pays the price for getting his own head beat in. And he doesn't articulate it as a crusader for justice, and he wouldn't say that, but he instinctively knows, I'm here with this camera, I can record the truth.
Right.
You know what I mean? That nobody else is going to see it except, you know, the guy who gets beat up, but the guy who gets beat up, unless he has any evidence to it, nobody's going to believe him, but I can make the observer, the believer, because now I'm going to show you what happened.
Right. It's very much like evidence. It's a sort of desire to collect and have evidence of of a crime or of the reality.
Yes.
Yeah. That feels sort mm-hmm. of like somewhat in that hard-boiled and impulsive,
you know? Yes,
getting exactly. to the truth, I guess.
Right. Right. Exactly. You're right. So that, right. And of course, you know, as we know that invariably this character, I'm sure as your character, they get drawn in and they become a kind of, you know, I guess the term is amateur sleuth, but, and yet there's somebody who is really in a certain way out there on the front lines, you know, taking these photos, and understanding that, their photos have an impact beyond just, you know, selling them to the newspaper and getting that paycheck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Why was it important for you to have your character be a Korean War vet?
Oh, I was kind of well, the real truth is, you know, Alan, among those influences were, you know, the films of Sam Fuller, who interesting enough was a World War II vet, and yet he wrote, you know, he did this. Well, he did a couple of films. He did eventually write The Big Red One, I guess, which is kind of the autobiographical one about his experiences in the war. But he did this trilogy of Korean War films, right? These sort of low budget, almost grindhouse kind of films, but they're great, right? Fixed Bayonets, Steel Helmets, and China Gate, which has Nat King Cole in it with Gene Barry, of all people, and Angie Dickinson. How about that? who, by the way, is still alive. I think he just turned 100.
Yeah.
But truth be told, it's the influence. It's the you know, the raw, powerful, propulsive, to use that term that John said, effects of those Sam Fuller films that were on my mind, and I thought, well, okay, let's put, you know, I want to put Harry up a little bit, he could still be in the 60s and obviously be a World War II vet. In fact, one of his buddies is a World War II vet, but I thought, well, I'll make him just a little bit younger. We'll put him in the Korean War, because not a lot sometimes is written about the Korean War, particularly in fiction, or certainly fiction now. And I thought, well, that'd be kind of interesting. And not for nothing, it is, in fact, in the States, it is, in fact, the first time the armed forces are integrated. And more to the point, and I mentioned this in the book, when MacArthur, the war hero from World War II, he was in charge of the troops the American force in Korea, and he was not going to. I mean, even though the order had been signed, Truman signed the order to integrate the troops, MacArthur was opposed to it, so he wasn't going to do it. Now, eventually, MacArthur gets replaced, not because of that, but some other insubordination, other insubordinate acts that he does, and it's the general who replaces him is the one that then integrates the troops. So I thought it would be kind of interesting. Not to hang a big flag on that, but just that when we meet Harry initially in the book, And when he runs into Ben Kinslow, his old buddy, Ben's white, but they were pals. They were Fox old buddies. And though he hadn't seen each other in a while, although Ben at one point had lived in LA and moved away, I thought it would be kind of nice to have that kind of as a friendship of these two. We don't, as I said, we don't hang a lantern on it. We don't make a big deal about it. But Harry, too, knows it's kind of interesting, you know, having grown up mostly in the black community, meeting this guy who's a guy he gets along with. And then what does it mean for Harry then to have that disrupted when this guy dies under mysterious circumstances?
Now, you know, being that you based it around kind of events, real life events, do you also put that as a character in the sense of the event and the location itself? Do you write that like you would write a character?
Yes, but that also means, Alan, that I take liberties, right? That, you know, you know, there is a kind of interesting line you walk when you write an historical novel, which is to say, when you watch Inglourious Basterds by Tarantino, and he kills Hitler and I guess it's Goebbels in the theater. Yeah. Right, and which we know there didn't happen, but it, you know, or the last one where the Tate LaBianca murders don't happen in L.A. Yeah. Brad, right, knocks off the three Manson followers. So in some ways, yes, I find that's fine. I think you could do that. I think it's fiction. I think it's fine. I think everything is fair game. On the other hand, there are probably some historical events I want to, you know, preserve as they happen, and yet I want to then, in a zealot kind of way, insert my characters into those events, right? So it is true that King had a rally here in L.A. I think it is true that Harry Adams was there to take pictures, because I think I've seen some of Adams' shots, because a lot of the stuff was preserved out here at one of the universities. So I believe Harry Adams was there. So to that extent, right, I'm being a kind of true to that historical time, and yet, of course, I do want the liberty, as I would with any character, historical or not, to be able to then do with them as I will, to tell the story I want to tell. So yes, to that extent, history is a character. History, like the, you know, like place and setting, have some grip on us, hopefully, right, and have some pull on us as a reader, but I'm not so slavish to the facts that I won't have fun with alternate realities. I guess that's the way to say it.
It's been a lot of that lately. Well, you know, and that brings me to the point then, when you touch off on this type of reality, you know, the humanity of a lot, yeah, of what goes on in the U.S. and, you know, civil rights and just everything in that area, and the way things are the last, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years, I don't know, it seems to be a blur now, but for the last little while, and what people buy in as what they think is real and what isn't, like there's, it's no longer, it's a very.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Very blurred line now between.
Yes, it is. Between, it really
you
is.
You know, because you did, you know, there's, yeah. It's people, some wholeheartedly believe in some things that are just complete fantasy, but they believe right. it with their yes. lives. So when yes. you've got all that stuff going on and the, and nutballs running around and all this stuff happening, do you worry about any kind of a backlash or in another sense, maybe an automatic kind of a term placed on you as a writer? Well, he's just like he's a lefty. He's not important.
Yeah, right.
He's biased. They'll say a lot worse names. I mean, but you know,
that's right. That's
but
right.
Does it matter that you're not going to connect with that whole, that part of the audience?
Oh, well, no, listen, Alan, my hope of hopes is that they will want to burn my book in a big, in a big old fire. And therefore, well, first they got to buy them, right? So as long as they buy them, and then they won't have this big bonfire, you know what I mean? Yeah. Stack some of these books high, stack them high, keep burning them.
Yeah.
You know, I'll help them. I'll even, you know what I mean? But on reality, on the real, yes, I suppose. Well, to the extent that, listen, I'm an entertainer. I hope I'm telling you an entertaining story. And I hope that whatever is woven through it in terms of current events or events in the past that somehow, you know, echo and mirror to the mm-hmm. present and all that, I want to give you that, right? Because I do want to set my books in reality or a certain reality, but I also want to tell you, hopefully, a good mystery story, a good hard-boiled story, and I want to give you good characters that you can latch on to, that you have some empathy for, and keep those juggling things happening, so that you know, at no one time, for instance, at no one time does Harry turn around and give you, you know, some kind of Marxist analysis about what it is that he's doing. His girlfriend might, because she's a Marxist, but Harry wouldn't, and Harry sort of scoffs at that. So, which is good, I think. I think because you obviously don't want to create one note characters, and you also don't want to create all characters that all have the same viewpoint. You want to give them different takes on life. I mean, one of Harry's buddies is Strummer Edwards, and Strummer is a gangster, right? But you know, Strummer is now kind of plowed some of his ill-gotten gains into legitimate or at least semi-legitimate businesses. He runs a blind pig, which is to say a bar that does not have a legitimate license. And he runs a kind of floating casino in the back of the joint. And, but you know, Harry rubs shoulders with this guy. Harry rubs shoulders with a buddy of his, Josh Nakano, who is a Japanese American, who's a little bit older than Harry. But who served in World War II as part of the Go for Broke, which was in fact an all Japanese unit in the war. Japanese Americans who, you know, put their lives on the line to prove that they were you know, loyal Americans, that they shouldn't be, they and their countrymen should not be, who were Americans, should not be taken off to internment camps and what have you. So I guess I just try to give you, I try to present as rich a tapestry as I can, and I try to give the characters, I guess the term we use now is agency, but, you know, try to make them live. But I also try to give them different points of view. I mean, otherwise, yeah, it's just a one note thing, and then I guess, you know, it's boring for anybody. But I think as long as you can kind of imbue their lives with, I think, purpose, and try to make their dialogue not preachy and not heavy on you know, platitudes or what have you, but make it real. Make it sound right. I think I'm, you know, I think I'm doing my job.
What is it you hope when someone comes and buys your book and they read it at the end of the book? What is it you hope they take away from it? Is it purely the entertainment, or is there something else you want them?
Well, I'm hoping that they I'm hoping that they got a satisfying read. I'm hoping they enjoyed, you know, that time, that journey they took, and the chance, right, that they took with me to read that book, to, you know, take the time, and however they acquired the book, or they listened to it, you know, on audio. Yes, so I hope they were entertained. I hope they were satisfied. And yes, I hope, and hopefully they maybe got some sense of that time period, or some sense of that world that they may not know about, or some glimpse into a part of life that maybe they found of interest, or maybe they was new to them. That's, which is great, right? And or something that they came from, and just, they, you know, try to see how inaccurate I was in some things. Yeah. So to that extent, I hope that it was fulfilling. I guess that's the best word to describe it. That it was fulfilling on maybe more than one level, or maybe it's only fulfilling, or maybe it's only okay on one level for them. In which case that's okay too. But that they didn't come away thinking they were reading some, you know, political tract, some heavy handed, polemic, but that in fact, what if those elements show up, that those elements then seem, organic and real to the story.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting because, you know, fiction comes across too, you know, politically overt or polemic. It can kind of fall flat, right?
That's right. 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 Exactly.
Yeah. I'm curious, like, you know, do you think that historical fiction or historical, you know, since we're talking mysteries, historical mysteries, it have a unique sort of ability to talk about current events in a fresh way? I mean, was there a reason why you went historical, I guess is what I'm asking.
You know, yeah, John, I think, yeah, I think initially, or maybe somewhere in the dawn of this, to reel it back, I guess I always knew it was going to be historical, only because once I got fascinated, like I said, once I got fascinated with the real life Harry and Ouija and King in town. Well, of course, you know, King is long gone. So yes, it almost by necessity, it had to be then. And the idea that, you know, looking from now, from where we sit in 2022, using, I mean, you know, there's still photography, but photography itself has changed so much. Right. And I know a buddy of mine who's, you know, a friend of mine who's, you know, who started as a photographer back in the days when, you know, you still had to develop film, and now he still does that, but he also does stuff with digital, but he's still in demand, because he has a certain eye, he has a certain way, you know what I mean? All those are factors, you know, to your point, all those are factors in the aesthetic. All those are ways in which, you make the photo happen, or the idea that one of the fascinations I think we have with photography, more than even you know, film or video, is to capture that one specific moment, that one brief second, you know, the artist backstage the doctor coming out of the operating room, and they, you know, they've been in there 7 hours, and maybe they saved the patient or maybe they didn't save the patient, right? Mm-hmm. And they just, that 1 second where they, you know, he or she is taking off, you know, their face mask, and they're taking off their headgear, and it just in their eye, you know, eyes are what has occurred, the toll that it has taken on them, right? Mm-hmm. And you know what I mean? And you capture that, it freeze it in a moment, then we, the viewer, can see that, can interpret that, but then we might have these, all these other ways in which we take that photo with us. And as I said, sort of different than even if you were to have a black and white or a color, you know, documentary crew following that doctor around. Although, of course, you would still get a different kind of impression, right? You would still receive that information and have something to say about it or have some thoughts about it. So, yeah, I think all that to say is that, yeah, it seemed kind of interesting to me that then push it to happen in 63. Because, well, it is specifically King has come to town then, but idea then, now as I go forward, you know, the next Harry book starts right in the middle of the Watts riots, which is in 65, mm-hmm. And you know what I mean? And so, yeah, just the idea that we can get into these events that have been written about in fiction and in nonfiction, and there's documentary about them, but the idea that now I can have this character of mine inserted into those events. And so that now you get to see those events from his point of view. Yeah, it was just a keen interest to me.
Yeah. And it's a great way for getting a reader into a historical time period that they may or may think they know something about, but don't know that much about. A follow-up question is, you know, what was LA like in 1963? What was going on? What was the atmosphere?
Well, even I was too young to remember, but certainly from what I recall from my dad, mm-hmm. you know, talking with his buddies about back in the day of LA, you know, working class guys, guys who had come west, men and women, black men and women who had come from, you know, those areas of the country where they thought, at least in the West, there would be a bit more freedom. And maybe there was some and maybe there wasn't some, right? Because it was still a city, as I write about in the book, that still had housing covenants, still had a fairly pronounced color line in terms of where you could go and where you couldn't go, or at least where you could go and not be there after dark. So that, you know, it's a city of contradictions. It is a city of promise, right? Mm-hmm. It is a city of migrants and immigrants. And yet at the same time, it's a city, because it does have, LA certainly at that time had the notion of becoming the metropolis, right? Though it was never, unlike say New York City and Robert Moses and all that stuff, you know, there were plans, you know, but I guess LA was so used to be just, you know, sprawl, right?
Right.
We'll create, you know, that's part of what's in the book, right? The freeway is coming through. Cause so of course we'll just create more freeways, we'll just create more byways. Or where the airport is in LA, technically it was actually in another municipality. So of course we just took it back because, you know, it's the airport and we're not going to call it your airport. We're going to call it Los Angeles International Airport, and we're going to get the taxes for it. So yeah, how do you like that? You know, or in the movie Chinatown, which is accurate in the sense of, How did we get water to L.A.? Well, we went out the New Orleans Valley and we stole their water. You know what I mean? So, right. So, but that, you know, that's, well, you got to break a few eggs, right, to you know, make the omelet of a big city. And so all those things, right, all those are sort of, you know, laying their levels of it. And part of it is, I suppose, with Harry as he starts to, as I said, you know, starts to go into the underneath and starts to look into those layers as really how it affects him and his community, right? It always comes back to that, I think, for Harry. And so he certainly wouldn't. I guess by the second book, as Harry's starting to understand a little bit more about his role in this, but certainly it's the idea that he has kind of fallen into this, that it wasn't an intentional project of his, an intentional thought of his to become this kind of, excavator of the future. But I suppose in a certain way, he's found himself doing that.
Now, social media. How are you with the new world of connection? Are you big with this? Do you have like a lot of social media accounts? Are you big with interacting or what?
Ellen, I have no idea what you kids do. I really don't. beyond Facebook, I understand there's Instagram. I understand there's TikTok. I understand there's a whole bunch of other stuff, right? Man, I have only a passing sense of what all that is, but I do none of that. It just seems so much work. It just seems so, you know what I mean? Even the idea that, I was slow to even getting, well, hell, I'm so, I had a flip top before I had this, this smartphone. You can't see me, but I'm holding it up now looking at the damn thing. I am fascinated by it, right? Because, right, apparently this thing has more memory than, those satellites we used to send up, correct? Right? You know what I mean? It's all that stuff is just kind of fascinating to me. And what's available on it, what you can tap into. But I'm fascinated by social media and sort of to get to the point you raised earlier and how, of course, it is, I think, corrupted people's minds. Because we can find whatever you believe in, whatever thing you want to go for, we can find our niche, right? We can find it on the internet somewhere, right? Either the above ground web or what they call the dark web, whatever it is, right? and for good and for ill, how it has affected us as a society, right? Or the notion that people take, even the idea that people take selfies, I find a little interesting and a little strange in some regard, right? Or the idea now that, and you'll see this now in mystery stories, you'll see it on TV shows too, where you'll track people's, social media movements, right? These mass shooters and what they post and this and that. So it is kind of fascinating. It is very interesting to me that we've become, I don't know what the term is, right? But we're all, jacked in to some extent, right? To lesser or greater degree to these artificial, what are they, cyberways, the byways, whatever they are. And let alone, right, by the way, fascinating that now there's a whole group of people who are influencers, right? Mm-hmm. I find it's amazing. You know what I mean? Right?
They
post whatever they post, right? I mean, about whatever shoe they're wearing or whatever it is, right? And of course, now they're encouraged, you pay them now to show your product. Because it's really, right? In the end, it really is the same thing. You're selling soap, but you're just selling soap in a different way.
So you need to be on TikTok dancing with yourself.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Apparently, they're selling lots of books on TikTok these days.
Isn't that right? Yeah.
But John, you can't do it.
You can't do it overtly, can you? You need, there was a couple of young ladies who had some kind of book, but you need somebody else showing your book, right?
Yeah.
If we ourselves get on there, well, then that's just too transparent, right? That's right.
Right. You got someone else.
Maybe I can pay an influencer.
There you go.
Now you're getting it. No.
Now I'm finally understanding. Okay. Yeah. I get it now. I get it.
So what are we talking? So you, how do people find you then?
I have a website that's not well maintained, but it is, that's my fault. It's my fault that it's not well maintained. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just gdphillips.com. So they can find me there. And I should probably occasionally update it, which I sort of do. But then I guess, and then I am on Facebook. Occasionally I'll get some kind of message, through Facebook.
Right.
right? You know, what do you call it? I am instant message. See, I know that. I know these terms yeah. kids use. But yes, that's how they can find me. But, you know, that's assuming, by the way, Alan, that I want to be found, yeah. right? I mean, it could just be that I don't want to be found.
Or carrier pigeon.
Yeah. Now you have hit it. Yes. Yes. And the carrier pigeon is extinct. No, it's the passenger pigeon that went extinct. Is that right? Is that right? One of those pigeons went extinct. But yes, absolutely. Carrier pigeon, now you're talking, baby. Now that's my speed. That's right. That's perfect.
So now we know how to find you.
Now you know how to find
you. Well, that's interesting. Right. How was it with this book just coming out? You must have written through the COVID. And so how was that on your writing? And I mean this in the sense of, you know, so you kind of got locked down and all these unusual events. You got people protesting it, fake, and all that stuff. All this stress going on outside your door. Did it affect your writing either way, like good, positive or negative or anything go on?
Well, I think in a positive way. I mean, as I said, I mean, you know, my background is as a community organizer, is somebody who's been involved around anti-police abuse work from back in the day, and you know, worked in political campaigns or local political campaigns, that kind of thing. So it did my heart good to see people out like in Ferguson and what have you, I found those events, from my perspective, uplifting and sort of restorative in the sense of, you know, all is not lost with humanity. You know, as a counterweight to certainly what we've gone through here in the States in the last several years. So in that regard, you know, so the outside world still existed, and I was aware of it and followed it. But in that regard, I guess I was buoyed so that I still did my job. I still did the work on getting the book done. But I guess the real answer is I didn't feel I was writing into the ether, right? That I was writing towards something, not necessarily, you know, contributing to the big picture, or maybe in a small way contributing to the big picture. But the idea being that, I could show you this slice of LA in 63 and how in some ways it echoes up to the present today, but that in the end you couldn't let any one event cripple you. Like, you know, Harry gets beat up, he gets roughed up by the cops, that happens to him, but Harry kind of keeps going. I mean, he takes stock and he reassesses, but he keeps moving forward. You can't let it immobilize you. I guess that's the point, right? You got to take it all in and kind of weigh it and figure it out for yourself. And where do I fit in? But you can do that and you can still move forward.
Yeah. 1963 Los Angeles. That's where we want it to make America great again. Is that?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know. Oh, yeah. They may be thinking about 50s.
Yeah. That sounds right. 50s.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if it ever was, but anyway, that's really good. How do you like the new publishing world these days? Like all the self-published stuff and everything going on around us.
Well, I've never self-published, but it is true that when I first started, which was in the, you know, 90s, I guess I was first published in 94. This is before we had print on demand and what have you. So the advances, I'm fascinated by being an old school print. I'm fascinated by the new print technology. I think that's pretty interesting. But back in those days, I was actually a partner in a small press that we published my novel, we published some other people's work. And so we would go through the whole process of editing and what have you and distribution. We had to have our titles distributed because you couldn't just, like I said, it was before print on demand, so you couldn't just print enough to send out. We actually had to have them, you know, stocks somewhere in a warehouse, all this stuff. So I learned a lot. So I think the idea now that those floodgates, you know, the means of production, as it were, are a bit more at hand, I think are very fascinating. I mean, I think you get a lot of stuff that's, you know, whatever it is. But I think you get, you know, there's some gems in there, too. There's some very interesting stuff being done, so... I think it's kind of interesting. I think it's very kind of a fascinating time.
Well, it certainly is. You know, people like me can get published. No.
There you go.
There you go. That's sad. Well, this is a really interesting conversation. Do you like, I have to do this one other one, because do you like old classic noir mysteries, or do you like the modern ones better?
I like them both. I there's something to be said for the old stuff, right? You know, out of the past, what did I just see again recently? The Maltese Falcon. I mean, the third version, right? The best version with Bogart and Mary Astor.
Right.
But I like some of the new stuff, the neo, I guess neo noir, I guess you'd call it. I'm a fan. Like, I was thinking of, I got invited to the inaugural Dallas Noir Film Festival a month or so ago. Me and a couple other guys, a couple of the writers, basically my agent, our agent who lives in Dallas, got us invited. And we just sort of hung out and watched old movies and talk stuff. I was going to say a word that you're going to have to bleep. Talk stuff. But then thinking about other, because we were also brainstorming about other kinds of noir. So there's been some good stuff. I was thinking of, there was a great little film, but this is even now some years old. You guys ever see Bound?
Yeah, Bound is great.
Wachowski did it. Yeah, I thought that was great. It was a great riff, right? It was a great riff on the setup and who was the, you know, the two women and who was the butch one and all that. And then ripping off the boy. I just thought, man, that's pretty clever. You know, that's a great, you know, send up of those tropes. And so, yeah, I'm a fan of stuff that, or, you know, I've been watching, it's entering its last season. I'm sorry, it's final season, because I guess they stopped and they're going to finish up the latter of the four. Better Call Saul, right?
Oh, yeah.
Which is kind of the prequel to Breaking Bad, and Breaking Bad, which I enjoyed immensely. And so, you know, and now finish this off by saying, into my golden years, you know, I've fallen into some TV work, although, I've, you know, I've had stuff optioned and what have you in the past, but I'm a staff writer on a show called Snowfall, which is set in the 80s in Los Angeles. And it's about crack in the CIA. And so we have these really compelling, dark, powerful, driven characters that we're now taking to their final journey, and it's been a great experience.
Final journey, like Star Trek.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Sorry, but anyway, the book that you need to get out and pick up, it's called One Shot Harry, and what else can I say? Our guest is the author of that book, Gary Phillips. Thank you for being on the show.
Well, you guys, Alan and John, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Our pleasure. Absolutely.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.